in order to get your spouse to do something you want. The object of love is not getting something you want, but doing something for the well-being of the one you love. It is a fact, however, that when we receive affirming words, we are far more likely to be motivated to reciprocate and do something our spouse desires. Encouraging words. Giving verbal compliments is only one way to express words of affirmation to your spouse. Another dialect is encouraging words. The word encourage means to inspire courage. All of us have areas in which we feel insecure. We lack courage, and that lack of courage often hinders us from accomplishing the positive things that we would like to do. The latent potential within your spouse in his or her areas of insecurity may await your encouraging words. Allison had always liked to write. Late in her college career, she took a few courses in journalism. She quickly realized that her excitement about writing exceeded her interest in history, which had been her academic major. It was too late to change majors, but after college, and especially before the first baby, she wrote several articles. She submitted one article to a magazine, but when she received a rejection slip, she never had the courage to submit another. Now that the children were older and she had more time to contemplate, Allison was again writing. Keith, Allison's husband, had paid little attention to Allison's writing in the early days of their marriage. He was busy with his own vocation and caught up in the pressure of climbing the corporate ladder. In time, however, Keith had realized that life's deepest meaning is not found in accomplishments, but in relationships. He had learned to give more attention to Allison and her interest. So it was quite natural one night for him to pick up one of Allison's articles and read it. When he finished, he went into the den where Allison was reading a book. With great enthusiasm, he said, "I hate to interrupt your reading, but I have to tell you this. I just finished reading your article on making the most of the holidays. Allison, you are an excellent writer. This stuff ought to be published. You write clearly. Your words paint pictures that I can visualize. You have a fascinating style. You've got to submit this stuff to some magazines." "Do you really think so?" Allison asked hesitantly. "I know so," Keith said. "I'm telling you, this is good." When Keith left the room, Allison did not resume her reading. With the closed book in her lap, she dreamed for 30 minutes about what Keith had said. She wondered if others would view her writing the same way he did. She remembered the rejection slip she had received years before, but she reasoned that she was a different person now. Her writing was better. She had had more experiences. Before she left the chair to get a drink of water, Allison had made a decision. She would submit her articles to some magazines. She would see if they could be published. Keith's encouraging words were spoken many years ago. Allison has had numerous articles published since then and now has a book contract. She's an excellent writer, but it took the encouraging words from her husband to inspire her to take the first step in the arduous process of getting an article published. Perhaps your spouse has untapped potential in one or more areas of life. That potential may be awaiting your encouraging words. Perhaps she needs to enroll in a course to develop that potential. Maybe he needs to meet some people who have succeeded in that area, who can give him insight on the next step he needs to take. Your words may give your spouse the courage necessary to take the first step. Please note that I am not talking about pressuring your spouse to do something that you want. I'm talking about encouraging him to develop an interest that he already has. For example, a wife might pressure her husband to look for a more lucrative job. The wife thinks she's encouraging her spouse, but to him, it sounds more like condemnation. But if he has the desire and motivation to seek a better position, her words will bolster his resolve. Until he has that desire, her words will come across as judgmental and guilt-inducing. They express not love, but rejection. If, however, he says, "You know, I've been thinking about starting a handyman business on the side," then she has the opportunity to give words of encouragement. Encouraging words would sound like this: "If you decide to do that, I can tell you one thing, you will be a success. That's one of the things I like about you. When you set your mind to do something, you do it. If that's what you want to do, I will certainly do everything I can to help you." Such words may give him the courage to start drawing up a list of potential clients. Encouragement requires empathy and seeing the world from your spouse's perspective. We must first learn what is important to our spouse. Only then can we give encouragement. With verbal encouragement, we are trying to communicate, I know, I care, I am with you, how can I help? We are trying to show that we believe in him and his abilities. We are giving credit and praise. Most of us have more potential than we will ever develop. What holds us back is often a lack of courage. A loving spouse can supply that all-important catalyst. Of course, encouraging words may be difficult for you to speak. It may not be your primary love language. It may take great effort for you to learn this second language. That will be especially true if you have a pattern of critical or condemning words. But I can assure you that it will be worth the effort. Kind words. Love is kind. If, then, we are to communicate love verbally, we must use kind words. That has to do with the way we speak. The same sentence can have two different meanings, depending on how you say it. The statement, I love you, when said with kindness and tenderness, can be a genuine expression of love. But what about, I love you? The question mark changes the whole meaning of those three words. Sometimes our words say one thing, but our tone of voice says another. We are sending double messages. Our spouse will usually interpret our message based on our tone of voice, not the words we use. I would be delighted to wash the dishes tonight. Said in a snarling tone will not be received as an expression of love. On the other hand, we can share hurt, pain, and even anger in a kind manner, and that will be an expression of love. I felt disappointed and hurt that you didn't offer to help me this evening. Said in an honest, kind manner can be an expression of love. The person speaking wants to be known by her spouse. She is taking steps to build intimacy by sharing her feelings. She is asking for an opportunity to discuss a hurt in order to find healing. The same words expressed with a loud, harsh voice will not be an expression of love, but an expression of condemnation and judgment. The manner in which we speak is exceedingly important. An ancient sage once said, "A soft answer turns away anger." When your spouse is angry and upset and lashing out with words of heat, if you choose to be loving, you will not reciprocate with additional heat, but with a soft voice. You will receive what he is saying as information about his emotional feelings. You will let him tell you of his hurt, anger, and perception of events. You will seek to put yourself in his shoes and see the event through his eyes, and then express softly and kindly your understanding of why he feels that way. If you have wronged him, you will be willing to confess the wrong and ask forgiveness. If your motivation is different from what he is reading, you will be able to explain your motivation kindly. You will seek understanding and reconciliation, and not to prove your own perception as the only logical way to interpret what has happened. That is mature love. Love to which we aspire if we seek a growing marriage. Love doesn't keep a score of wrongs. Love doesn't bring up past failures. None of us is perfect. In marriage, we do not always do the best or the right thing. We have sometimes done and said hurtful things to our spouses. We cannot erase the past. We can only confess it and agree that it was wrong. We can ask for forgiveness and try to act differently in the future. Having confessed my failure and asked forgiveness, I can do nothing more to mitigate the hurt it may have caused my spouse. When I have been wronged by my spouse, and she has painfully confessed it and requested forgiveness, I have the option of justice or forgiveness. If I choose justice and seek to pay her back or make her pay for her wrongdoing, I am making myself the judge and she the felon. Intimacy becomes impossible. If, however, I choose to forgive, intimacy can be restored. Forgiveness is the way of love. I am amazed at how many individuals mess up every new day with yesterday. They insist on bringing into today the failures of yesterday, and in so doing, they pollute a potentially wonderful day. I can't believe you did it. I don't think I'll ever forget it. You can't possibly know how much you hurt me. I don't know how you can sit there so smugly after you treated me that way. You ought to be crawling on your knees, begging me for forgiveness. I don't know if I can ever forgive you. Those are not the words of love, but of bitterness and resentment and revenge. The best thing we can do with the failures of the past is to let them be history. Yes, it happened. Certainly it hurt, and it may still hurt. But he has acknowledged his failure and asked your forgiveness. We cannot erase the past, but we can accept it as history. We can choose to live today free from the failures of yesterday. Forgiveness is not a feeling, it is a commitment. It is a choice to show mercy, not to hold the offense up against the offender. Forgiveness is an expression of love. I love you, I care about you, and I choose to forgive you. Even though my feelings of hurt may linger, I will not allow what has happened to come between us. I hope that we can learn from this experience. You are not a failure because you have failed. You are my spouse, and together we will go on from here. Those are the words of affirmation expressed in the dialect of kind words. Humble words. Love makes requests, not demands. When I demand something from my spouse, I become a parent and she the child. It is the parent who tells the 3-year-old what he ought to do and, in fact, what he must do. That is necessary because the 3-year-old does not yet know how to navigate in the treacherous waters of life. In marriage, however, we are equal adult partners. We are not perfect to be sure, but we are adults and we are partners. If we are to develop an intimate relationship, we need to know each other's desires. If we wish to love each other, we need to know what the other person wants. The way we express those desires, however, is all important. If they come across as demands, we have erased the possibility of intimacy and will drive our spouse away. If, however, we make our needs and desires known in the form of a request, we are giving guidance, not ultimatums. The husband who says, "Could you make that good pasta one of these nights?" is giving his wife guidance on how to love him and thus build intimacy. On the other hand, the husband who says, "Can't we ever have a decent meal around here?" is being adolescent in making a demand, and his wife is likely to fire back, "Okay, you cook." The wife who says, "Do you think it would be possible for you to clean the gutters this weekend?" is expressing love by making a request. But the wife who says, "If you don't get those gutters cleaned out soon, they're going to fall off the house. They already have trees growing out of them," has ceased to love and has become a domineering spouse. When you make a request of your spouse, you are affirming his or her worth and abilities. You are in essence indicating that she has something or can do something that is meaningful and worthwhile to you. When, however, you make demands, you have become not a lover, but a tyrant. Your spouse will feel not affirmed, but belittled. A request introduces the element of choice. Your mate may choose to respond to your request or to deny it, because love is always a choice. That's what makes it meaningful. To know that my spouse loves me enough to respond to one of my requests communicates emotionally that she cares about me, respects me, admires me, and wants to do something to please me. We cannot get emotional love by way of demand. My spouse may in fact comply with my demands, but it is not an expression of love. It's an act of fear or guilt or some other emotion, but not love. Thus, a request creates the possibility for an expression of love, whereas a demand suffocates that possibility. More ways to affirm. Words of affirmation is one of the 5 basic love languages. Within that language, however, there are many dialects. We have discussed a few already, and there are many more. Entire volumes and numerous articles have been written on these dialects. All of the dialects have in common the use of words to affirm one's spouse. Psychologist William James said that possibly the deepest human need is the need to feel appreciated. Words of affirmation will meet that need in many individuals. If you are not a man or woman of words, if it is not your primary love language, but you think it may be the love language of your spouse, let me suggest that you keep a notebook entitled Words of Affirmation. When you read an article or book on love, record the words of affirmation you find. When you hear a lecture on love, or you overhear a friend saying something positive about another person, write it down. In time, you will collect quite a list of words to use in communicating love to your spouse. You may also want to try giving indirect words of affirmation. That is, saying positive things about your spouse when he or she is not present. Eventually, someone will tell your spouse and you will get full credit for love. Tell your wife's mother how great your wife is. When her mother tells her what you said, it will be amplified, and you will get even more credit. Also, affirm your spouse in front of others when he or she is present. When you are given public honor for an accomplishment, be sure to share the credit with your spouse. You may also try your hand at writing words of affirmation. Written words have the benefit of being read over and over again. I learned an important lesson about words of affirmation and love languages years ago in Little Rock, Arkansas. My visit with Bill and Betty Jo was on a beautiful spring day. They lived in a cluster home with white picket fence, green grass, and spring flowers in full bloom. It was idyllic. Once inside, however, I discovered that the idealism ended. Their marriage was in shambles. 12 years and 2 children after the wedding day, they wondered why they had married in the first place. They seemed to disagree on everything. The only thing they really agreed on was that they both loved the children. As the story unfolded, my observation was that Bill was a workaholic who had little time left over for Betty Jo. Betty Jo worked part-time, mainly to get out of the house. Their method of coping was withdrawal. They tried to put distance between each other so that their conflicts would not seem so large. But the gauge on both love tanks read empty. They told me that they had been going for marriage counseling but didn't seem to be making much progress. They were attending my marriage seminar, and I was leaving town the next day. This would likely be my only encounter with Bill and Betty Jo. I decided to put everything on the table. I spent an hour with each of them separately. I listened intently to both stories. I discovered that in spite of the emptiness of their relationship and their many disagreements, they appreciated certain things about each other. Bill acknowledged, "She's a good mother. She also is a good housekeeper and an excellent cook when she chooses to cook." But, he continued, "there's simply no affection coming from her. I work my tail off, and there's simply no appreciation." In my conversation with Betty Jo, she agreed that Bill was an excellent provider. "But," she complained, "he does nothing around the house to help me, and he never has time for me. What's the use of having the house, the recreational vehicle, and all the other things, if you don't ever get to enjoy them together?" With that information, I decided to focus my advice by making only one suggestion to each of them. I told Bill and Betty Jo separately that each one held the key to changing the emotional climate of the marriage. "That key," I said, "is to express verbal appreciation for the things you like about the other person, and for the moment, suspending your complaints about the things you don't like." We reviewed the positive comments they had already made about each other, and I helped each of them write a list of those positive traits. Bill's list focused on Betty Jo's activities as a mother, housekeeper, and cook. Betty Jo's list focused on Bill's hard work and financial provision for the family. We made the list as specific as possible. Betty Jo's list looked like this. "He hasn't missed a day of work in 12 years. He is aggressive in his work. He has received several promotions through the years. He's always thinking of ways to improve his productivity. He makes the house payment each month. He's a good financial manager. He bought us a recreational vehicle 3 years ago. He keeps up with the yard work or hires someone to do it. He is generous with finances. He takes the garbage out once a month. He agrees that I can use the money from my part-time job any way I desire." Bill's list looked like this. "She makes the beds every day. She keeps our house clean and orderly. She gets the kids off to school every morning with a good breakfast. She cooks dinner about 3 days a week. She buys the groceries. She helps the children with their homework. She transports the children to school and church activities. She teaches first grade Sunday school. She takes my clothes to the cleaners." I suggested that they add to the list things they noticed in the weeks ahead. I also suggested that twice a week they select one positive trait and express verbal appreciation for it to the spouse. I gave one further guideline. I told Betty Jo that if Bill happened to give her a compliment, she was not to give him a compliment at the same time, but rather, she should simply receive it and say, "Thank you for saying that." I told Bill the same thing. I encouraged them to do that every week for 2 months, and if they found it helpful, they could continue. If the experiment did not help the emotional climate of the marriage, then they could write it off as another failed attempt. The next day, I got on the plane and returned home. I made a note to call Bill and Betty Jo 2 months later to see what had happened. When I called them in midsummer, I asked to speak to each of them individually. I was amazed to find that Bill's attitude had taken a giant step forward. He had guessed that I had given Betty Jo the same advice I'd given him. But that was all right. He loved it. She was expressing appreciation for his hard work and his provision for the family. She has actually made me feel like a man again. We've got a ways to go, Dr. Chapman, but I really believe we're on the road. When I talked to Betty Jo, however, I found that she had only taken a baby step forward. She said, "It has improved some, Dr. Chapman. Bill is giving me verbal compliments, as you suggested, and I guess he's sincere. But he's still not spending any time with me. He's still so busy at work that we never have time together." As I listened to Betty Jo, I knew that I had made a significant discovery. The love language of one person is not necessarily the love language of another. It was obvious that Bill's primary love language was words of affirmation. He was a hard worker, and he enjoyed his work, but what he wanted most from his wife was expressions of appreciation for his work. That pattern was probably set in childhood, and the need for verbal affirmation was no less important to his adult life. Betty Jo, on the other hand, was emotionally crying out for something else. That brings us to love language number 2. Your turn. Share instances with your spouse when words had a profound impact on your life, positively or negatively. If your spouse's love language is words of affirmation, I want to give you some suggestions. Number 1. To remind yourself that words of affirmation is your spouse's primary love language, print the following on a 3x5 card and put it on a mirror or other place where you will see it daily. Words are important. Words are important. Words are important. Write it 3 times. Number 2. For 1 week, keep a written record of all the words of affirmation you give your spouse each day. On Monday, I said, "You did a great job on this meal. You really look nice in that outfit. I appreciate your picking up the dry cleaning." On Tuesday, I said, and each day, record what you've said. You might be surprised how well or how poorly you're speaking words of affirmation. Number 3. Set a goal to give your spouse a different compliment each day for 1 month. If an apple a day keeps the doctor away, maybe a compliment a day will keep the counselor away. You may want to record these compliments also, so you will not duplicate the statements. Number 4. As you watch TV, read, or listen to people's conversations, look for words of affirmation that people use. Write those affirming statements in a notebook or keep them electronically. Read through these periodically and select those you could use with your spouse. When you use one, note the date on which you used it. Your notebook may become your love book. Remember, words are important. Number 5, write a love letter, a love paragraph, or a love sentence to your spouse, and give it quietly or with fanfare. You may someday find your love letter tucked away in some special place. Words are important. Number 6, compliment your spouse in the presence of his parents or friends. You'll get double credit. Your spouse will feel loved, and the parents will feel lucky to have such a great son-in-law or daughter-in-law. Number 7. Look for your spouse's strengths and tell her how much you appreciate those strengths. Chances are she will work hard to live up to her reputation. Number 8. Tell your children how great their mother or father is. Do this behind your spouse's back and in her presence. Chapter 5. Love language number 2, quality time. I should have picked up on Betty Jo's primary love language from the beginning. What was she saying on that spring day when I visited her and Bill in Little Rock? "Bill is a good provider, but he doesn't spend any time with me. What good are all our things if we don't ever enjoy them together?" What was her desire? Quality time with Bill. She wanted his attention. She wanted him to focus on her, to give her time, to do things with her. By quality time, I mean giving someone your undivided attention. I don't mean sitting on the couch watching television together. When you spend your time that way, ABC or NBC has your attention, not your spouse. What I mean is sitting on the couch with the TV off, looking at each other and talking, giving each other your undivided attention. It means taking a walk, just the two of you, or going out to eat and looking at each other and talking. Have you ever noticed that in a restaurant, you can almost always tell the difference between a dating couple and a married couple? Dating couples will look at each other and talk. Married couples sit there and gaze around the restaurant. You'd think they went there to eat. When I sit with my wife and give her 20 minutes of my undivided attention, and she does the same for me, we are giving each other 20 minutes of life. We will never have those 20 minutes again. We are giving our lives to each other. It is a powerful emotional communicator of love. One medicine cannot cure all diseases. In my advice to Bill and Betty Jo, I had made a serious mistake. I assumed that words of affirmation would mean as much to Betty Jo as they would to Bill. I had hoped that if each of them would give adequate verbal affirmation, the emotional climate would change and both of them would begin to feel loved. It worked for Bill. He began to feel more positive about Betty Jo. He began to sense genuine appreciation for his hard work. But it had not worked as well with Betty Jo, for words of affirmation was not her primary love language. Her love language was quality time. I got back on the phone and thanked Bill for his efforts in the past 2 months. I told him that he'd done a good job of verbally affirming Betty Jo and that she had heard his affirmations. But Dr. Chapman, he said, she's still not very happy. I don't think things are much better for her. You are right, I said, and I think I know why. The problem is that I suggested the wrong love language. Bill hadn't the foggiest idea what I meant. I explained that what makes one person feel loved emotionally is not always the thing that makes another person feel loved emotionally. He agreed that his language was words of affirmation. He told me how much that had meant to him as a boy and how good he felt when Betty Jo expressed appreciation for the things he did. I explained that Betty Jo's language was not words of affirmation, but quality time. I explained the concept of giving someone your undivided attention. Not talking to her while you read the newspaper or watch television, but looking into her eyes, giving her your full attention, doing something with her that she enjoys doing, and doing it wholeheartedly. Like going to the symphony with her, he said. I could tell the lights were coming on in Little Rock. Dr. Chapman, that is what she has always complained about. I didn't do things with her. I didn't spend any time with her. We used to go places and do things before we were married, she said, but now you're too busy. That's her love language, all right, no question about it. But what am I going to do? My job is so demanding. Tell me about it, I said. For the next 10 minutes, he gave me the history of his climb up the organizational ladder, of how hard he had worked and how proud he was of his accomplishments. He told me of his dreams for the future and that he knew that within the next 5 years he would be where he wanted to be. Do you want to be there alone or do you want to be there with Betty Jo and the children, I asked. I want her to be with me, Dr. Chapman. I want her to enjoy it with me. That's why it has always hurt so much when she criticizes me for spending time on the job. I'm doing it for us. I want her to be a part of it, but she's always so negative. Are you beginning to see why she's so negative? I ask. Her love language is quality time. You have given her so little time that her love tank is empty. She doesn't feel secure in your love. Therefore, she is lashed out at what was taking your time, in her mind, your job. She doesn't really hate your job. She hates the fact that she feels so little love coming from you. There's only one answer, Bill, and it's costly. You have to make time for Betty Jo. You have to love her in the right love language. I know you're right, Dr. Chapman. Where do I begin? Do you have a legal pad handy? The one on which we made the list of the positive things about Betty Jo? It's right here. Good. We're going to make another list. What are some things that you know Betty Jo would like you to do with her? Things she has mentioned through the years. Here is Bill's list. Spend weekends in the mountains, sometimes with the children and sometimes just the two of us. Meet her for lunch at a nice restaurant or sometimes even at McDonald's. Get a babysitter and take her out to dinner, just the two of us. When I come home at night, sit down and talk with her about my day and listen as she tells me about her day. She doesn't want me to watch TV while we're trying to talk. Spend time talking with the children about their school experiences. Spend time playing games with the children. Go on a picnic with her and the children on Saturday and don't complain about the ants and the flies. Take a vacation with the family at least once a year. Go walking with her and talk as we walk. Those are the things she's talked about through the years, he said. You know what I'm going to suggest, don't you, Bill? Do them, he said. That's right. One a week for the next 2 months. Where will you find the time? You will make it. You are a wise man, I continued. You would not be where you are if you were not a good decision maker. You have the ability to plan your life and to include Betty Jo in your plans. I know, he said. I can do it. And, Bill, this does not have to diminish your vocational goals. It just means that when you get to the top, Betty Jo and the children will be with you. That's what I want more than anything. Whether I'm at the top or not, I want her to be happy, and I want to enjoy life with her and the children. The years have come and gone. Bill and Betty Jo have gone to the top and back. But the important thing is that they've done it together. The children have left the nest. Bill and Betty Jo agree that these are their best years ever. Bill has become an avid symphony fan. Betty Jo has made an unending list in her legal pad of things she appreciates about Bill. He never tires of hearing them. He has now started his own company and is near the top again. His job is no longer a threat to Betty Jo. She is excited about it and encourages him. She knows that she is number one in his life. Her love tank is full, and if it begins to get empty, she knows that a simple request on her part will get Bill's undivided attention. Focused attention. It isn't enough to just be in the same room with someone. A key ingredient in giving your spouse quality time is giving them focused attention, especially in this era of many distractions. When a father is sitting on the floor rolling a ball to his 2-year-old, his attention is not focused on the ball, but on the child. For that brief moment, however long it lasts, they are together. If, however, the father is talking on the phone while he rolls the ball, his attention is diluted. Some husbands and wives think they are spending time together, when in reality, they are only living in close proximity. They are in the same house at the same time, but they are not together. A wife who is texting while her husband tries to talk to her is not giving him quality time, because he does not have her full attention. Quality time does not mean that we have to spend our together moments gazing into each other's eyes. It means that we are doing something together and that we are giving our full attention to the other person. The activity in which we are both engaged is incidental. The important thing, emotionally, is that we are spending focused time with each other. The activity is a vehicle that creates the sense of togetherness. The important thing about the father rolling the ball to the 2-year-old is not the activity itself, but the emotions that are created between the father and his child. Similarly, a husband and wife playing tennis together, if it is a genuine quality time, will focus not on the game, but on the fact that they are spending time together. What happens on the emotional level is what matters. Our spending time together in a common pursuit communicates that we care about each other, that we enjoy being with each other, that we like to do things together. Quality conversation. Like words of affirmation, the language of quality time also has many dialects. One of the most common dialects is that of quality conversation. By quality conversation, I mean sympathetic dialogue where two individuals are sharing their experiences, thoughts, feelings, and desires in a friendly, uninterrupted context. Most individuals who complain that their spouse does not talk do not mean literally that he or she never says a word. They mean that he or she seldom takes part in sympathetic dialogue. If your spouse's primary love language is quality time, such dialogue is crucial to his or her emotional sense of being loved. Quality conversation is quite different from the first love language. Words of affirmation focus on what we are saying, whereas quality conversation focuses on what we are hearing. If I am sharing my love with you by means of quality time, and we're going to spend that time in conversation, it means I will focus on drawing you out, listening sympathetically to what you have to say. I will ask questions, not in a badgering manner, but with a genuine desire to understand your thoughts, feelings, and hopes. I met Patrick when he was 43 and had been married for 17 years. I remember him because his first words were so dramatic. He sat in the leather chair in my office, and after briefly introducing himself, he leaned forward and said with great emotion, "Dr. Chapman, I have been a fool, a real fool." What has led you to that conclusion? I asked. I've been married for 17 years, he said, and my wife has left me. Now I realize what a fool I've been. I repeated my original question. In what way have you been a fool? My wife would come home from work and tell me about the problems in her office. I would listen to her and then tell her what I thought she should do. I always gave her advice. I told her she had to confront the problem. Problems don't go away. You have to talk with the people involved or your supervisor. You have to deal with the problems. The next day, she would come home from work and tell me about the same problems. I would ask her if she did what I'd suggested the day before. She would shake her head and say no. So I'd repeat my advice. I told her that was the way to deal with the situation. She would come home the next day and tell me about the same problems. And again, I would ask her if she had done what I had suggested. She would shake her head and say no. After 3 or 4 nights of that, I would get angry. I would tell her not to expect any sympathy from me if she wasn't willing to take the advice I was giving her. She didn't have to live under that kind of stress and pressure. She could solve the problem if she would simply do what I told her. It hurt me to see her living under such stress because I knew she didn't have to. The next time she'd bring up the problem, I would say, "I don't want to hear about it. I've told you what you need to do. If you're not going to listen to my advice, I don't want to hear it." I would withdraw and go about my business. Now I realize that she did not want advice when she told me about her struggles at work. She wanted sympathy. She wanted me to listen, to give her attention, to let her know that I could understand the hurt, the stress, the pressure. She wanted to know that I loved her and that I was with her. She didn't want advice. She just wanted to know that I understood. But I never tried to understand. I was too busy giving advice, and now she's gone. Why can't you see these things when you're going through them? He asked. I was blind to what was going on. Only now do I understand how I failed her. Patrick's wife had been pleading for quality conversation. Emotionally, she longed for him to focus attention on her by listening to her pain and frustration. Patrick was not focusing on listening, but on speaking. He listened only long enough to hear the problem and formulate a solution. He didn't listen long enough or well enough to hear her cry for support and understanding. Many of us are like Patrick. We are trained to analyze problems and create solutions. We forget that marriage is a relationship, not a project to be completed or a problem to be solved. A relationship calls for sympathetic listening with a view to understanding the other person's thoughts, feelings, and desires. We must be willing to give advice, but only when it is requested and never in a condescending manner. Most of us have little training in listening. We are far more efficient in thinking and speaking. Learning to listen may be as difficult as learning a foreign language, but learn we must if we want to communicate love. That is especially true if your spouse's primary love language is quality time and his or her dialect is quality conversation. Fortunately, numerous books and articles have been written on developing the art of listening. I will not seek to repeat what is written elsewhere, but suggest the following summary of practical tips. Number one, maintain eye contact when your spouse is talking. That keeps your mind from wandering and communicates that he or she has your full attention. Number two, don't listen to your spouse and do something else at the same time. Remember, quality time is giving someone your undivided attention. If you're doing something you cannot turn from immediately, tell your spouse the truth. A positive approach might be, "I know you're trying to talk to me and I'm interested, but I want to give you my full attention. I can't do that right now, but if you will give me 10 minutes to finish this, I'll sit down and listen to you." Most spouses will respect such a request. Number three, listen for feelings. Ask yourself, what emotion is my spouse experiencing? When you think you have the answer, confirm it. For example, "It sounds to me like you're feeling disappointed because I forgot." That gives him the chance to clarify his feelings. It also communicates that you are listening intently to what he is saying. Number four, observe body language. Clenched fist, trembling hands, tears, furrowed brows, and eye movement may give you clues as to what the other is feeling. Sometimes body language speaks one message while words speak another. Ask for clarification to make sure you know what she is really thinking and feeling. Number five, refuse to interrupt. Recent research has indicated that the average individual listens only 17 seconds before interrupting and interjecting their own ideas. If I give you my undivided attention while you're talking, I will refrain from defending myself or hurling accusations at you or dogmatically stating my position. My goal is to discover your thoughts and feelings. My objective is not to defend myself or to set you straight. It is to understand you. Learning to talk. Quality conversation requires not only sympathetic listening, but also self-revelation. When a wife says, "I wish my husband would talk. I never know what he's thinking or feeling," she is pleading for intimacy. She wants to feel close to her husband, but how can she feel close to someone whom she doesn't know? In order for her to feel loved, he must learn to reveal himself. If her primary love language is quality time, and her dialect is quality conversation, her emotional love tank will never be filled until he tells her his thoughts and feelings. Self-revelation does not come easy for some of us. Many adults grew up in homes where the expression of thoughts and feelings was not encouraged, but condemned. To request a toy was to receive a lecture on the sad state of family finances. The child went away feeling guilty for having the desire, and he quickly learned not to express his desires. When he expressed anger, the parents responded with harsh and condemning words. Thus, the child learned that expressing angry feelings is not appropriate. If the child was made to feel guilty for expressing disappointment at not being able to go to the store with his father, he learned to hold his disappointment inside. By the time we reach adulthood, many of us have learned to deny our feelings. We are no longer in touch with our emotional selves. A wife says to her husband, "How did you feel about what Steve did?" And the husband responds, "I think he was wrong. He should have." But he is not telling her his feelings. He is voicing his thoughts. Perhaps he has reason to feel angry, hurt, or disappointed. But he has lived so long in the world of thought that he does not acknowledge his feelings. When he decides to learn the language of quality conversation, it will be like learning a foreign language. The place to begin is by getting in touch with his feelings, becoming aware that he is an emotional creature in spite of the fact that he has denied that part of his life. If you need to learn the language of quality conversation, begin by noting the emotions you feel away from home. Carry a small notepad and keep it with you daily. 3 times each day, ask yourself, "What emotions have I felt in the last 3 hours? What did I feel on the way to work when the driver behind me was riding my bumper? What did I feel when I stopped at the gas station and the automatic pump did not shut off and the side of the car was covered in gas? What did I feel when I got to the office and found that the project I was working on had to be completed in 3 days when I thought I had another 2 weeks?" Write down your feelings in the notepad and a word or two to help you remember the event corresponding to the feeling. Your list may look something like this. Event, tailgater. Feelings, angry. Event, gas station. Feelings, very upset. Event, work project due in 3 days. Feelings, frustrated and anxious. Do that exercise 3 times a day, and you will develop an awareness of your emotional nature. Using your notepad, communicate your emotions and the events briefly with your spouse as many days as possible. In a few weeks, you will become comfortable expressing your emotions with him or her, and eventually, you will feel comfortable discussing your emotions toward your spouse, the children, and events that occur within the home. Remember, emotions themselves are neither good nor bad. They are simply our psychological responses to the events of life. Based on our thoughts and emotions, we eventually make decisions. When the tailgater was following you on the highway and you felt angry, perhaps you had these thoughts. "I wish he would lay off. I wish he would pass me. If I thought I wouldn't get caught, I'd press the accelerator and leave him in the twilight. I should slam on my brakes and let his insurance company buy me a new car. Maybe I'll pull off the road and let him pass." Eventually, you made some decision, or the other driver backed off, turned, or passed you, and you arrived safely at work. In each of life's events, we have emotions, thoughts, desires, and eventually, actions. It is the expression of that process that we call self-revelation. If you choose to learn the love dialect of quality conversation, That is the learning road you must follow. Dead seas and babbling brooks. Not all of us are out of touch with our emotions, but when it comes to talking, all of us are affected by our personality. I have observed two basic personality types. The first I call the Dead Sea. In the little nation of Israel, the Sea of Galilee flows south by way of the Jordan River into the Dead Sea. The Dead Sea goes nowhere. It receives, but it does not give. This personality type receives many experiences, emotions, and thoughts throughout the day. They have a large reservoir where they store that information, and they are perfectly happy not to talk. If you say to a Dead Sea personality, "What's wrong? Why aren't you talking tonight?" he will probably answer, "Nothing's wrong. What makes you think something's wrong?" And that response is perfectly honest. He is content not to talk. He could drive from Chicago to Detroit and never say a word and be perfectly happy. On the other extreme is the babbling brook. For this personality, whatever enters into the eye gate or the ear gate comes out the mouth gate, and there are seldom 60 seconds between the two. Whatever they see, whatever they hear, they tell. In fact, if no one is at home to talk to, they will call someone else. "Do you know what I saw? Do you know what I heard?" If they can't get someone on the telephone, they may talk to themselves because they have no reservoir. Many times, a Dead Sea marries a babbling brook. That happens because when they are dating, it is a very attractive match. If you are a Dead Sea and you date a babbling brook, you will have a wonderful evening. You don't have to think, "How will I get the conversation started tonight? How will I keep the conversation flowing?" In fact, you don't have to think at all. All you have to do is nod your head and say, "Uh-huh," and she will fill up the whole evening, and you will go home saying, "What a wonderful person." On the other hand, if you are a babbling brook and you date a Dead Sea, you will have an equally wonderful evening, because Dead Seas are the world's best listeners. You will babble for 3 hours, he will listen intently to you, and you will go home saying, "What a wonderful person." You attract each other. But 5 years after marriage, the babbling brook wakes up one morning and says, "We've been married 5 years, and I don't know him." The Dead Sea is saying, "I know her too well. I wish she would stop the flow and give me a break." The good news is that Dead Seas can learn to talk, and babbling brooks can learn to listen. We are influenced by our personality, but we are not controlled by it. One way to learn new patterns is to establish a daily sharing time in which each of you will talk about 3 things that happened to you that day and how you feel about them. I call that the minimum daily requirement for a healthy marriage. If you will start with the daily minimum, in a few weeks or months, you may find quality conversation flowing more freely between you. Quality activities. In addition to the basic love language of quality time, or giving your spouse your undivided attention, there's another dialect called quality activities. At a recent marriage seminar, I asked couples to complete the following sentence. "I feel most loved by my husband or wife when..." Here is the response of a 29-year-old husband who has been married for 8 years. "I feel most loved by my wife when we do things together. Things I like to do and things she likes to do. We talk more. It sort of feels like we're dating again." That is a typical response of individuals whose primary love language is quality time. The emphasis is on being together, doing things together, giving each other undivided attention. Quality activities may include anything in which one or both of you have an interest. The emphasis is not on what you're doing, but on why you're doing it. The purpose is to experience something together, to walk away from it feeling, "He cares about me. He was willing to do something with me that I enjoy, and he did it with a positive attitude." That is love, and for some people, it is love's loudest voice. One of Emily's favorite pastimes is browsing in bookshops, from sprawling superstores to hole-in-the-wall used book dealers. Her husband, Jeff, less of an avid reader, has learned to share these experiences with Emily and even point out books she may enjoy. Emily, for her part, has learned to compromise and not force Jeff to spend hours in the stacks. As a result, Jeff proudly says, "I vowed early on that if there was a book Emily wanted, I would buy it for her." Jeff may never become a bookworm, but he has become proficient at loving Emily. Quality activities may include such things as putting in a garden, visiting historic neighborhoods, shopping for antiques, going to a concert, taking long walks, or having another couple over for soup and bread. The activities are limited only by your interest and willingness to try new experiences. The essential ingredients in a quality activity are, 1, at least one of you wants to do it. 2, the other is willing to do it. And 3, both of you know why you're doing it, to express love by being together. One of the byproducts of quality activities is that they provide a memory bank from which to draw in the years ahead. Fortunate is the couple who remembers an early morning stroll along the coast, the spring they planted the flower garden, the time they got poison ivy chasing a rabbit through the woods, the night they attended their first Major League Baseball game together, the one and only time they went skiing together and he broke his leg, the amusement parks, the concerts, the cathedrals, and, oh yes, the awe of standing beneath the waterfall after the 2-mile hike. They can almost feel the mist as they remember. Those are memories of love, especially for the person whose primary love language is quality time. And where do we find time for such activities, especially if both of us have vocations outside the home? We make time, just as we make time for lunch and dinner. Why? Because it is just as essential to our marriage as meals are to our health. Is it difficult? Does it take careful planning? Yes. Does it mean we have to give up some individual activities? Perhaps. Does it mean we do some things we don't particularly enjoy? Certainly. Is it worth it? Without a doubt. What's in it for me? The pleasure of living with a spouse who feels loved and knowing that I have learned to speak his or her love language fluently. A personal word of thanks to Bill and Betty Jo in Little Rock, who taught me the value of love language number 1, words of affirmation, and love language number 2, quality time. Now it's on to Chicago and love language number 3. Your turn. What in your marriage detracts from spending quality time? If your spouse's love language is quality time, let me give some suggestions. Number 1, take a walk together through the old neighborhood where one of you grew up. Ask questions about your spouse's childhood. Ask, what are the fun memories of your childhood? Then, what was most painful about your childhood? Number 2, go to the city park and rent bicycles. Ride until you're tired, then sit and watch the ducks. When you get tired of the quacks, roll on to the rose garden. Learn each other's favorite color of rose and why. Number 3, ask your spouse for a list of 5 activities that he would enjoy doing with you. Make plans to do one of them each month for the next 5 months. If money is a problem, space the freebies between the "we can't afford this" events. Number 4, ask your spouse where she most enjoys sitting when talking with you. The next week, text her one afternoon and say, "I want to make a date with you one evening this week and sit on the porch and talk. Which night and what time would be best for you?" Number 5. Think of an activity your spouse enjoys, but which brings little pleasure to you. NASCAR? Browsing the flea markets? Working out? Tell your spouse that you are trying to broaden your horizons and would like to join him in this activity sometime this month. Set a date and give it your best effort. Number 6. Plan a weekend getaway just for the two of you sometime within the next 6 months. Be sure it is a weekend when you won't have to call the office or have a commitment with your kids. Focus on relaxing together, doing what one or both of you enjoy. Number 7. Make time every day to share with each other some of the events of the day. When you spend more time on Facebook than you do listening to each other, you can end up more concerned about your 100 friends than about your spouse. Number 8. Have a "let's review our history" evening once every 3 months. Set aside an hour to focus on your history. Select 5 questions each of you will answer, such as, who was your best or worst teacher in school and why? When did you feel your parents were proud of you? What is the worst mistake your mother ever made? What is the worst mistake your father ever made? What do you remember about the religious aspect of your childhood? Each evening, agree on your five questions before you begin your sharing. At the end of the five questions, stop and decide on the five questions you will ask next time. Number 9. Camp out in the living room. Spread your blankets and pillows on the floor. Get your Pepsi and popcorn. Pretend the TV is broken and talk like you used to when you were dating. Talk till the sun comes up or something else happens. If the floor gets too hard, go back upstairs and go to bed. You won't forget this evening. Chapter 6, Love Language Number 3, Receiving Gifts. I was in Chicago when I studied anthropology. By means of detailed ethnographies, that is, printed descriptions of a particular culture, I visited fascinating peoples all over the world. I went to Central America and studied the advanced culture of the Mayans and the Aztec. I crossed the Pacific and studied the tribal peoples of Melanesia, Polynesia. I studied the Eskimos of the northern tundra and the aboriginal Ainus of Japan. I examined the cultural patterns surrounding love and marriage and found that in every culture I studied, gift-giving was a part of the love-marriage process. Anthropologists are intrigued by cultural patterns that tend to pervade cultures, and so was I. Could it be that gift-giving is a fundamental expression of love that transcends cultural barriers? Is the attitude of love always accompanied by the concept of giving? Those are academic and somewhat philosophical questions, but if the answer is yes, it has profound practical implications for North American couples. Juice for you. I took an anthropology field trip to the island of Dominica. Our purpose was to study the culture of the Carib Indians, and on the trip, I met Fred. Fred was not a Carib, but a young black man of 28 years. Fred had lost a hand in a fishing by dynamite accident, and since the accident, he could not continue his fishing career. He had plenty of available time, and I welcomed his companionship. We spent hours talking about his culture. Upon my first visit to Fred's house, he said to me, "Mr. Gary, would you like to have some juice?" To which I responded enthusiastically. He turned to his younger brother and said, "Go get Mr. Gary some juice." His brother turned, walked down the dirt path, climbed a coconut tree, and returned with a green coconut. "Open it," Fred commanded. With three swift movements of the machete, his brother uncorked the coconut, leaving a triangular hole at the top. Fred handed me the coconut and said, "Juice for you." It was green, but I drank it, all of it, because I knew it was a gift of love. I was his friend, and to friends you give juice. At the end of our weeks together, as I prepared to leave that small island, Fred gave me a final token of his love. It was a crooked stick, 14 inches in length, that he had taken from the ocean. It was silky smooth from pounding against the rocks. Fred said that the stick had lived on the shores of Dominica for a long time, and he wanted me to have it as a reminder of the beautiful island. Even today, when I look at that stick, I can almost hear the sound of the Caribbean waves, but it is not as much a reminder of Dominica as it is a reminder of love. A gift is something you can hold in your hand and say, "Look, he was thinking of me," or "she remembered me." You must be thinking of someone to give him a gift. The gift itself is a symbol of that thought. It doesn't matter whether it costs money. What is important is that you thought of him. And it is not the thought implanted only in the mind that counts, but the thought expressed in actually securing the gift and giving it as an expression of love. Mothers remember the days their children bring a flower from the yard as a gift. They feel loved, even if it was a flower they didn't want picked. From early years, children are inclined to give gifts to their parents, which may be another indication that gift-giving is fundamental to love. Gifts are visual symbols of love. Most wedding ceremonies include the giving and receiving of rings. The person performing the ceremony says, "These rings are outward and visible signs of an inward and spiritual bond that unites your two hearts in love that has no end." That is not meaningless rhetoric. It is verbalizing a significant truth. Symbols have emotional value. Perhaps that is even more graphically displayed near the end of a disintegrating marriage, when the husband or wife stops wearing the wedding ring. It is a visual sign that the marriage is in serious trouble. One husband said, when she threw her wedding rings at me and angrily walked out of the house, slamming the door behind her, I knew our marriage was in serious trouble. I didn't pick up her rings for 2 days. When I finally did, I cried. The rings were a symbol of what should have been, but lying in his hand,